come, come, ye saints. No toil nor labor fear.
And so there's that comfort that you get that. So I questioned that. I wondered about that for a long time through high school. When I got to college, I remember talking to my institute. I loved institute as well. I was one of those. Again, I'm trying to live everything with exactness. I'm going to institute, taking every class I can fit into my schedule to learn the gospel, preparing to go on a mission. I remember talking to my institute teachers about it, them being very, very knowledgeable about gospel and the scriptures. And they always thought this was kind of puzzling as well. They've never heard of a blessing that just says you're adopted in Israel, but no tribe. And they're like, yeah, you probably should have a tribe. Everyone is of a tribe. I've never heard of anyone not being of a tribe. And so here again.
Yeah, I haven't heard of that either.
And so here again, I'm like, okay, Dustin's different. Dustin's different. Why am I different? I
just want to be like everybody else.
I just want to be like everybody else. Please let me blend. Right before I go on my mission, I meet with the stake president at the university in Tucson. So I have a mission, a stake president in Tucson, who I share this with. And he says, no, you need to go back to the patriarch in your home stake back in Phoenix and have him do an addendum to your patriarchal blessing. And I said, what's that mean? He says, essentially, an addendum is he opens the blessing, adds a bit more, and then he closes it. He can say what he wants to add a whole bunch more blessings or anything else. He can do that. But you're specifically going because you need to have the lineage thing clarified. And then if he wants to pronounce any other blessings, he can do so. But it's an addendum to the blessing. And so he filled out. I had a recommend to go back to the patriarch. I called the patriarch back in Phoenix and scheduled an appointment to go back to get an addendum to my patriarchal blessing. He was kind of puzzled. He's like, we're doing a what? It's your blessing? And so he probably researched and pulled up my blessing he'd given me four or five years before.
So this is the same patriarch, yes.
So okay. I went back to the same patriarch that had given me my blessing when I was 14 years old. So I'm now 18, almost 19. And I remember going and meeting with him. And I remember, you know, in anticipation of going back to get my blessing, I'm like, okay, I know I'm going back to get my lineage clarified, which will be nice just because it's been a lurking question. But you know, I really hope he opens up and tells me, like, I'm going to be rich. I'm going to have this. This is an 18-year-old mindset. I'm like, he can open up the blessing. He can tell me so many more things now. I get to have a second bite at the apple with this patriarchal blessing thing. As this 18-year-old, very, very selfish, kind of going, gosh, I hope he tells me I'm going to have, like, this beautiful wife. And I'm going to have this and I'm going to have that. And so I go and I meet with the patriarch. And it was very anticlimactic, quite frankly. The patriarch was a little puzzled that I would be asking for clarification on this issue. And he was an older man, and he just was very, very – he was nice about it. But he said, no, Dustin, there's no need to modify your blessing. Your blessing says you are adopted into the house of Israel, that you will receive the blessings promised to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. But there's no need to clarify anymore your lineage. You are the lineage of Cain, but your blessing clarifies that you are adopted into the house of Israel, and you will get the blessings of wow. those who are of Israel. So for me, I just left there. I didn't get any special reopening of a blessing to give me worldly things, but even more importantly, I walked out of there just with a confirmation that this Canaanite doctrine teaching was real. And that's, again, I did something in the preexistence. I was born with this. But now here I am on earth. If I live righteously, according to my patriarchal blessing, I will receive all the blessings promised Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. So for me, it is...
And this is post the priesthood being given to blacks.
This is 1990. I got the initial blessing in 87. This is now the spring of 1991.
Yeah, which is kind of what blows my mind because, you know, if I would hear of this story, you know, I don't know, among the peers of my parents or, you know, I'd be like, well, it'd be easier to maybe think, well, that was just...
And I know this man that had served as my patriarch was a very good man. I mean, I believe he was even my family's home teacher when I was in high school. He had served as the bishop of the ward. I think he had served in other leadership callings before he was called as the patriarch a very diligent man. I mean, one of those that I remember hearing he fasted the day he was going to give a patriarchal blessing. And so when he spoke to you in your blessing, he was speaking for God. It was inspired. There was no reason ever to question, doubt, or anything. These were truths. Right. You're a descendant of Cain. Your blessing is very, very clear. You're adopted into the house of Israel, and you will receive all the blessings promised to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob if you are righteous and you live and you make choices that are in accordance with the gospel.
Well, that was very similar to your grandmother's position. I mean, good people in the church doing what they know to be right, trying their best. But if nobody above that takes responsibility or changes, like you're saying, what the original doctrine is, then we're just going to assume that's
still the doctrine. And I can tell you, I've had experiences in my adult life where I know that people still believe these things. Mm-hmm. They still believe these things. Mm-hmm. This was my experience with my patriarchal blessing. In college, I met another African American gal.
Yeah,
friend
I was
of mine.
Gonna ask you, Dean, is this common amongst
I never really talked to. I was curious about this as well. I was like, okay, am I the only one that has this type of a scenario? Or are there others? Is this with every black? So I met another black member of the church while I was in college. I remember just being very, very curious as we became friends, and I had enough trust with her to ask her about these things as well. And her blessing was similar. Her blessing didn't say adoption into the house of Israel. It said something to the effect that she can receive all the blessings in Zion as a member of the house of Israel, and that she would be eligible for these blessings. She's eligible for the blessings promised to Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, Joseph, Manasseh, and Ephraim. But again, no specific tribe.
And similar to yours in the sense of you're eligible or you will, so it's all future tense.
It's future tense that you will get these blessings in the future. And again, I don't know other people's blessings if they speak in this futuristic tense, because I don't. My patriarch talks a lot about things are futuristic. If you live this way, you'll have this blessing of that. So I didn't pay a whole lot of attention to the futuristic aspect of it. It was more the omission of a tribe, mm-hmm. of a specific tribe, both in mine and in hers. And
your siblings, because they're also biracial like you are, and do you know about if they've been given a tribe or not? Or
my brother, who's 2.5 years younger than I am, I think he got his blessing after I had gone back the second time.
Okay.
For my addendum, mm-hmm. my clarification thing. And he's of Ephraim.
So again, the same patriarch.
I believe it's the same patriarch, because my parents never moved. It would have been the home war, the home stake, the home patriarch. And his blessing references Ephraim. And I believe my other siblings were the same of Ephraim. I don't remember them ever having any kind of any anomaly, something that they were like, what is this? Why is mine different? Mm-hmm. And I remember being curious
wondering if maybe the visit you'd had with him had sparked his own rethinking of it.
I wonder if that had something to do with it. I can tell you I don't believe there were any other blacks that went to him to get their patriarchal blessings in the time that I got mine the first time in 87. Mm-hmm. I know there weren't any in my ward. There weren't any in my stake.
Like, this patriarch had not blessed a lot of African Americans.
No, 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 no. I think I would be very, very comfortable saying I was the first, and mm-hmm. then my family, because there weren't any others in our stake. I mean, he would have only been giving blessings to people in our stake.
Right.
And there weren't any other black families that I recall ever at anything. And so I probably was his first. It was 1987, you know, 9 years after the revelation. He had served in bishoprics and leadership prior to, so he understood the doctrines. He was a very devout man. Yeah, I mean, mm-hmm. I don't think there was any question in his mind. Blacks were descendants of Cain. Why would he have thought anything else?
Right.
As a faithful member of the church, why would he question Joseph Fielding Smith? Why would he question Bruce R. McConkie's reasoning and thinking of who blacks were? Right. So I believe in that he gave the blessing. He spoke for the Lord. I mean, there was no question in my mind that was the Lord's will. It was this blessing I have in front of me was dictated by the Lord.
Interesting.
And so I took it at that.
Right.
And so meeting this other friend in college and her having a similar blessing where there was no tribe assigned to her, it just said that she would be eligible for the blessings of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, the prophets.
Hmm.
Kind of an interesting verbiage again.
Yeah, definitely.
But if it also from a personal self-esteem, it reinforced that good grief.
Yeah.
What did I do?
Right.
What did I do in the preexistence that I was assigned to this race? I questioned it. I wondered, but I had enough faith in the church. I had enough faith in the leaders, in the brethren, these men of God. If they couldn't explain it, I was never going to be able to explain it. It was what it was, and I just accepted it. I got called on a mission to serve in New York City, and I knew in New York City I was going to interact with blacks and people of color, of different ethnic groups. And
can you talk a little bit about that? I mean, did you find yourself repeating these types of same doctrinal teachings to those who you were teaching now? And this is now early 90s, I'm assuming?
This is 91 to 93 is when I served in New York City. And I served in a Spanish-speaking mission. So I was primarily with Spanish-speaking members, but there were Dominicans, Puerto Ricans, Cubans, of those primary national backgrounds. And so I didn't teach any African-Americans, per se, in Harlem. I lived in Harlem, but I was focused on the Spanish-speaking members. But we would have some interesting discussions times in our apartment with the elders when we lived in when I was on my mission, and many of them, this is what they believed as well. They this is what they were taught. The Canaanite thing was there. It was something that they didn't have to live. So oftentimes I would ask questions and kind of try to get their perspective on things. They didn't know how to respond. They didn't know. I was more of the, again, probably even at 19 years old, the inquisitive intellectual young missionary who spent P-Day studying and studying.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm reading.
Anomaly.
I remember the elders getting mad because Elder Jones wanted to sit and read Jesus the Christ, and they wanted to go play basketball.
Right,
and I was like,
right.
I'm in my book, brethren. I'm in my book. So I'm reading articles of faith. I'm reading Talmage. I read everything I could get my hands on. I remember buying books on. Loving the scriptures and loving the gospel. I was determined I was going to go back and be a seminary teacher. Seminary teacher or law. I was going to go into law or seminary, and that was it. And so I just really got into trying to understand these things, because I would grapple with them. I hope you get the sense of, I believed it because there was no reason not to believe them.
Right.
And to not believe them would be a sign of me not showing faith.
It would put you back into that kind of conundrum of, you know, now if you don't believe, if you don't follow, then you're kind of proving that, yeah, you were lesser to begin with. You're back to the kind of fence sitter position.
Absolutely.
You know,
and you were kind of caught
in that catch-22.
Draw the line, and I'm going to follow this, I'm going to believe this, and I'm not going to question it. And the teachings are there. And I really, I remember, again, I would look at other ethnic groups and the issue of race. And the only other group in our Mormon theology or Mormon teachings, that's another group that had their dark skin, were the Lamanites. You get the Book of Mormon, you have the discussion about Lamanites, and they have a dark skin as well. And so I would think about, you know, they're the Lamanites. And I do remember about being about 20 years old, kind of on the mission, going, who says that my race is the Negro? The Negroes are the descendants of Cain. Why can't it be one of these other groups? And why isn't it the Polynesians? Why isn't these other groups? And I'd look at Polynesians, I'd look at their physical features. I'd met Tongans, I'd seen Samoans, and I'd look at their skin, look at mine, I'd look at some of their features, and I'm like, you know, they look like they have African blood in them. They look black. And my younger brother, who is a little darker than I am, people would always think he was a Samoan or a Tongan. They were always saying, are you Tongan, are you Samoan? He's like, no, my mom's white, my dad's black. But from his physical features, you'd think he was Polynesian. And so I'd look and I'd go, you know, why did they get to have the priesthood? I bet they have African blood in them. There's no way you're going to convince me that there's no African DNA. There's no genes, something there. I don't think we talked about DNA yet back in the 90s as much, but it was more genes. I would say, what genes do they have? They've got to have some genes, some blood that has African in them.
Well, and this is such an interesting point because, yeah, if you follow Mormon doctrine, the curse of dark skin has always been kind of put towards sin. You know, that's sin related. So yeah, whether you're Hispanic or Polynesian or any type of race where you're not going to be, I guess, Caucasian, there's that inferment that, yeah, this had to do at some point with sin.
Right.
And so why is it that we, even though they're all sinful, supposedly, why is it that only one group, you know, had to do with not having the priesthood? And to me, I guess, I mean, does this just jump all the way back to slavery? Is that really what this is about? That because of the issues around slavery back at the times of, I mean, back in the times of Joseph Smith and Brigham Young, they weren't dealing with Polynesians and Asians, and you know, they were dealing with African
Well, there's
American slaves.
right, and there weren't any Polynesians that they had to deal with. The Native Americans, because of our theology, because of the Book of Mormon, and what Joseph Smith said, the Native Americans were descendants of the Lamanites, and so we prescribed the Lamanite on them, and so there was obviously no priesthood restriction. From the Book of Mormon, we learned that they were a chosen people, the Lamanites, and that the Book of Mormon was written for their to redeem them and to bring the Lamanites to a remembrance of their God. So you have Joseph Smith and the early pioneers going on missions, going to these places. I don't think it's any accident that the church has been over in Polynesia and Hawaii and those islands for 100 years, because of the belief that there's the reference in the Book of Mormon that Hagoth, that he boarded a boat and took a bunch of people off the western coast, I believe is what the Book of Mormon talks about, and that he sailed westward and he took a couple trips and then he was lost to the rest of the Nephite people. And so one of the prophets, I can't remember who it was, said that essentially because it was the west coast and he got off on a boat and he went over towards the west, that the Polynesians are Lamanites. And that has been part of our teachings on race for over 100 years. And so the Polynesians are descendants of Hagoth. I believe there is a quote. I remember looking at it when I was in college in the Institute manual. There was an Institute manual. It had this quote in it. I can't remember which of the modern prophets was over there dedicating the Polynesian islands, Hawaii, and he was talking about Hagoth. He references Hagoth specifically and talks about them being descendants of the Lamanites and Lehi's seed, I think is what he talks about, Lehi's seed. So the Polynesians, because of this, have had a different status within the church. Absolutely.
Right.
It was different for them because they were tied to Lamanites. And theologically, in our church doctrine, there was no way ever to really have anything that was negative because the scriptures that we believe in, both the Book of Mormon and then modern Revelation,
Well, it gives
celebrate
them,
it.
yeah, it gives them the
It
rights
celebrates
of
them. It welcomes
the,
them. It gives them that.
and it gives them
Whereas,
the rights of the tribe of Israel. I mean, that's really
of
what it does.
Manasseh, absolutely. And
Right.
but Africans here, I mean, Joseph Smith actually was not, he was not pro-slavery. He was an abolitionist. I mean, the church in our history got in a lot of trouble in Missouri because the saints, many of the early converts were Northerners, and they were abolitionists. And when they're in Missouri, and the Missourians hear that the Mormons are with their polygamy and their being abolitionists, I mean, there was a double whammy there. They wanted the Mormons out of Missouri,
Right.
for those reasons. But grappling with race, I think after Joseph Smith died, because we know that when Joseph Smith was around, there were some blacks that were ordained. They did get the priesthood in Joseph Smith's
Yeah,
time.
that's what's so I mean that's I mean not I think Joseph Smith was obviously very progressive for his time. I'm sure he was still a racist in some regards. I'm sure you couldn't escape it at the time by any means. But he did give the priesthood to black men, and then it wasn't really until they migrated to Utah and Brigham Young was faced with the slavery issue and whether or not the southern, you know, converts that were coming from the south with slaves into Utah, whether or not Utah was going to be a slave state, that we start seeing some of these quotes that are, you know, kind of horrific.
Yeah, it was in 1852, and yeah, it was the territory of Utah. And Joseph Smith, Brigham Young gives a very passionate speech. And yeah, Utah was the first state to allow for slavery. I mean, that was the only territory. I think it was still just a territory at the time, but it was definitely west of the Mississippi. It was going to be the slave state, and yeah, it was. You had a lot of saints that were coming from the South that were bringing their slaves. There were a few that freed slaves that came across as pioneers. I remember learning these stories. I didn't learn these until I was older, probably 19, 20, going on my mission. I started doing more research on some of this, and it was news to me that there were actually blacks that came across and came to Utah. I didn't know that, and that Brigham Young had a man that came. I believe it was in his company. It was in his wagon that came with him. So I started learning about more of the African American history as it relates to Mormonism. It was just something that was just, you just didn't hear about. Until very recently, you just never heard about the black Mormon contribution to our Mormon history. Right. I would love to have heard all that when I was a kid. Like, right. I'm sure my grandmother would love to have heard that. It just was not a part of any of our books because, again, of the dark skin, the curse, that was all you read about blacks.
Right,
and maybe there was a desire not to acknowledge more their contributions at that time.
Right. Okay, so all the talk on adoption has me completely tangenting here, so I apologize. Back to your mother's story. She had given up her first child out of wedlock for adoption. And to this day, you don't have any contact with that half brother of yours, correct?
Correct.
There's nothing there, and
very little information to find him.
Right.
I know my mom when he would have been 18, she was really struggling that he might come find her.
Uh-huh.
I know she was very anxious about that, very stressed about that. It hasn't happened. I've looked on the internet. To try to find, I'm really at a loss as to where to begin. I have a birth date and a hospital.
Okay. Interesting. So then what, kind of going back to your own personal story, what kept her from putting you up for adoption as well? Because it was also out of wedlock. Were your parents, your biological father, was this something that he was going to, I mean, were they together for a while so that they kept you, or was he quickly out of the picture, or what was your...
I think they were together for a very short period of time, but right after I was born, talking to my grandmother about these things before I went on my mission, or maybe right after, as a grown-up talking about some of these adoption issues in my childhood, there was some discussion. I remember her telling me about my mother placing me up for adoption as well, because this was now the second time, and it was still not accepted. And she was struggling with that. And I think at this time period, this attempt, my grandmother wanted to have me placed in LDS Family Services, into the church's adoption agency. But at the time, the church didn't accept black kids, and so that was not an option.
Oh, wow.
So they wouldn't receive or place a black child. And then again, this is 1970. So this is all started the kind of this baggage. My grandmother I can just imagine her just, I mean, she just does not know what to do with her daughter and now her grandson. And
well, so this kind of, even today, that's kind of the counsel given to, you know, young girls who are pregnant to place their child with a family that can raise that child in the church and give them the, you know, blessings of a sealing and et cetera, et cetera. So even if your mother wanted to have done that, she couldn't have done that.
Oh yeah. It just was not an option to go that route for her. And so that my relationship with my mother was very, very strong. We're very close because, as my grandmother told me, she really fought to keep you. She was adamant that she was keeping her baby. She was not going to, after having been traumatized by the initial placement of her first son, she wasn't going to allow that to happen again. And so she and I have a very strong bond. She's very loyal to me. I'm very close to her. I just grew up with that sense of her just possessing me. I was her boy. That's all there was to it.
Hmm.
that I could sense, probably it's... because of the loss, the potential loss.
Right. Well, and I'm wondering if out of the, I guess I'm just wondering, you know, it seems like you got most of your doctrinal background as far as your race from your grandmother. Was your mother also aware of all these things, and did she address them and talk about them with you? Or do you think that if your grandmother, for instance, hadn't been around, that you wouldn't have been as aware of these types of teachings?
I probably would not have been aware, because my mother was less active and then was excommunicated. She just in the kind of inactive, really even beyond that. I wouldn't have gotten most of this if it wasn't for my grandmother, who grew up. I mean, these are the teachings, and she's one, like I said, kind of being the genealogist. She had the big library of all the church books, and she had this Church of the Negro, and she had. I remember they also gave me. There's another old one that's called It's You and Me, Lord, My Experience as a Black Mormon, written by Alan Cherry. And this is an autographed copy I have of this. I don't know exactly where my grandmother got this, but this was another book that I got as a kid. This was a 1970 copy of this book. Again, pre-1978 Revelation. So I was given this. I remember reading this as a teenager. I remember reading that book as a teenager. All these different things. But yeah, it was more my grandmother, because she was more kind of the scriptorian, the family. I mean, that was just kind of her role as the matriarch. She saw herself as making sure all of her posterity knew their heritage, knew where they came from. And for better or for worse, she instilled in me the Mormon pioneer heritage, but she also felt it was her responsibility to teach me these things that the brethren had taught about my race. But from her perspective, the way she saw it was that because I was biracial, there was a reason for it, and that I have this pioneer Mormon part of me that's supposed to elevate. It's supposed to help out. And so that was her explanation, her understanding, her justification for the mixed race, is that from her perspective, I was just a white Mormon kid.
Right, right.
But she knew that genetically and race, the way I was born, I was black as well.
So then,
and so all these things. And so she kind of coupled the two understandings, this Mormon heritage back to 1830 pioneers. This is our role. This is our mission in life, to bring to pass eternal life of man. We've got to do these different things, spread the gospel. And you're black, and you're to help out the black race. You're to help out people of color. You're supposed to do these different things, and you carry both of these responsibilities.
Right.
But she didn't shy away from teaching me what the leaders had taught her,
right?
Which were the teachings. I mean, these were the teachings, doctrines, policy, whatever you want to call it. It is what the brethren, how they explained it.
And do you think that your mother bought into these things as well, that she believed them as well and was fine with the fact that you were being taught these things?
She did, because I talked to her about these things as well. Mm-hmm. And she didn't question them either. My mom's never ever said, well, that leader, they're wrong. They don't know what they're talking about. Mm-hmm. I mean, that was just not part of my wiring by this point with these things. She'd accept that she would be in rebellion, that she would not follow the leaders, but never, were they wrong? No, absolutely not. They're always right.
And so
it's like
now,
that quote, Brigham Young's quote.
Right. So now as a father of four, and like you're saying, you know, with all of these, you know, you've got obviously a very multiracial home. What, you know, can you even imagine teaching your kids these types of thoughts, you know, these kinds of teachings and doctrines, and telling them that there's something inherently wrong with them and that they are now to be held responsible for something that they can't even remember doing, but that they still need to take responsibility for that, and that their God expects them to kind of just accept this about themselves?
No, absolutely not. And part of growing up and seeing different things, it's taken me a long time to come to terms with. I just don't believe the race-based theology. I mean, I can't accept that the color of my skin is the result of something that I did in the preexistence. I can't. I can't believe that with respect to black race. I can't believe that with respect to Asians. I mean, you look at some of the quotes by some of the leaders, even just 40, 50 years ago, some of the things that Mark E. Peterson, Elder Mark E. Peterson, one of the apostles, said about, I mean, Chinese and Asians and Hawaiians. I mean, it's the same type of, I mean, there are talks that he's given where he would explain why God is a segregationist. And he was very much an advocate of segregation. And he explained that, well, God segregated the races. If he wanted one race, there would have been one race. And you just kind of go, huh? Really? But I have to accept that these men believed this. This was true to them. And it was taught to many people as a truth. As a parent now today, my kids, again, four races, black, white, Chinese, and Mexican, and I look at them, and the funny thing that genetics are, my oldest has my skin color, has many of my African-American features. She has my nose. It's funny thing, she has kind of her grandmother's Asian eyes, but she's my skin color, and she kind of has more kinky, curly hair. My second daughter is one that when she was born and I'd take her to the store, people thought I was kidnapping her because she's as white as snow. She's white, but she's mine. She's all mine. And she's got little freckles all over her face, and she's absolutely adorable. My next child is my son. He's got my complexion, but he has this curly, kind of wavy, black, straight hair. It's not as kinky as his oldest sister, but he's my complexion. And then my third is my daughter, or my fourth is my daughter, and she's very, very fair skinned. She takes after my mom. She will fry and get burned in the sun just like her older sister. So I have two that are darker, two that are lighter. They amongst themselves recognize the skin color, even within our own family. They recognize that my dad is African American. He's they'll have even said, you know, the black grandpa, not the Mexican grandpa, because they've got two grandpas, and one's a black one, one's a Mexican one. Right. And then they know that my mom's white, that my mom is literally blonde hair, blue eyes. That's the white grandma. And then they've got their abuelita, their grandma, who's my mom's mom, who looks, I mean, she looks Asian. She looks Chinese. She doesn't look Mexican. She looks like Chinese. Right. And so you get our family together, and these questions of that race somehow predetermined your actions and preexistence determined this, it really seems nonsensical. Really. I can't.
It's such a beautiful picture that you're describing. I mean, to think that this would be considered wicked or evil or inferior in some way, just you talking about your children, you know, it's just such a beautiful vision that you create for us.
And amongst themselves, because again, I have two that are darker complected and two that are very, very fair and with freckles. I definitely don't want any type of sense that one is better than the other. Absolutely not. I would never have that amongst my children, that one race, one skin color is better than another. And as a father, I can't conceive that my Heavenly Father would be any different. Hmm. Why would he have one kid better than the next one?
Right.
If we're all truly his children, and I'm just an earthly parent, Why would I want? Why would I create this tension? Why would I create this? It doesn't make any sense to me at this point. I'm approaching 40. It just doesn't. It doesn't seem conceivable. And it's definitely something I'm not instilling in my kids. And we really haven't, because they're younger. Really haven't gotten into much of the Book of Mormon discussions about skin color. I'm anticipating how to deal with those things, because I don't know that I can accept, again, this is Heavenly Father, change someone's skin color because of this. And I know it's right in the Book of Mormon, it's there, but I have a hard time with it. I know that one thing we have done in recent years, and I've seen this just probably in the past 10 years, is we've taught this about the curse and the mark. It used to be that the curse and the mark were one and the same, that you were marked. You were cursed, and your skin was colored because of what you've done wrong. What has happened, and this is probably even just in the last 6-7 months, even the church has gone back and changed the headings in the Book of Mormon to be in more line that the curse is one thing, that's the curse, but the skin color is separate. We've bifurcated, we've separated the skin and the curse. Whereas if you go back and look at all of the previous writings of all the general authorities, the skin, the curse, and the mark were one and the same. There wasn't much difference there. Looking at what Bruce R. McConkie taught about the races, he says racial degeneration, quote unquote, racial degeneration resulting in differences in appearance and spiritual aptitude has risen since the fall. We know the circumstances under which the posterity of Cain were born with these characteristics of the black race. Again, you read this and he talks about, okay, my physical features are a degeneration. It's a racial degeneration. I'm a degenerate. You read that and you go, are you kidding me? Are you kidding me?
Well, let me expound on that, maybe where he'd get that. But I believe this is Brigham Young again. But he says, you see some classes of the human family that are black, uncouth, uncomely, disagreeable and low in their habits, wild, and seemingly deprived of nearly all the blessings of the intelligence that is generally bestowed upon mankind. You know, the first man that committed the odious crime of killing one of his brethren will be cursed the longest of any, one of the children of Adam. You know, and then he just kind of finishes up with, the Lord put a mark upon him, which is the flat nose and black skin.
Right. So you get that type of thinking from Brigham Young from over 100 years ago. You get this. This is 60s, 70s, 1960s and 70s. This isn't that long ago. You still have apostles with the same type of thinking talking about this. I read this, and you talk about racial degeneration or all the other races. It's the presumption that God's race was blonde-haired and blue-eyed and white. Really? Mm-hmm. You really think? You really believe that God's race is the blonde-haired, blue-eyed race, and everything else is a racial degeneration. It's mind-boggling. Mm-hmm. It's mind-boggling.
Well, especially when Jesus Christ wasn't blonde-haired, and I'm assuming
But you wouldn't think that if you look at some of the artwork and some of the statues and things, you would think that he was just this gorgeous blonde-haired, blue-eyed guy walking down the street. He's got Brad Pitt with long hair.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And so some of that stuff is, it's still there, and you just – It's mind-boggling. It's kind of funny because I used to think about this, again, the kind of the skin color curse thing, that my skin was a curse. Again, now we've talked about the mark and the curse are different these days. But when I was a kid, I remember going on campouts as a youth, going to Boy Scout camp, or we'd go as a combined youth up to different activities. And I remember all the white kids in the ward just were going on this – to float down the river or whatever, the Salt River or something like that, and everyone's lathering on all this sunscreen and stuff like that, and I remember seeing kids just get sunburned, just fried, and I'm going, is my skin cursed or is your skin cursed? Because that doesn't happen to me. And it was my mind. It was my only way to comically rationalize. I'm like, how can this be the curse? Because, you know, I don't blister up. I don't peel. I don't fry. And I don't get skin cancer. How can my skin be the curse? And it was just kind of, again, just kind of a funny way as a teenager to kind of look at these things and go, I don't know about this skin color thing being a curse. I really feel blessed. Yeah, and then, as a missionary serving in Harlem and serving in the Bronx, and my companions that were from Idaho and Utah that were white, and they just seemed to have a much harder time. And I could walk through the streets. I could just get my strut on, and I could just walk, and I felt fine. And I was like, you know, this skin color is not a curse. Believe me, it's not a curse.
Yeah.
Again, just in my own way, just trying to humorously rationalize and explain to myself or deal with the skin. My skin color is a curse. Why is my skin color a curse?
Well, as you talk, it just kind of reminds me of, you know, myself at those different ages and, you know, doing some of the same things that you did. And again, the mental energy that I never had to think about those things. You know, I never thought about, I wasn't comparing myself and looking at other people. And, I mean, I guess I've got issues maybe from a feminist perspective, but as far as when it came to race, I wasn't looking at my skin and ever even having to think about whether or not I had to put on sunscreen and whether or not I was cursed. And do you see what I'm saying? Like that, that stuff just never took up space in my brain. Whereas it's like all this space in your brain is being taken up by having to come to terms with this.
Absolutely. And I think that that's where a lot of members, the majority of members, don't recognize that this is an issue. And for me, I grew up in the church, and fortunately I had my grandmother there to kind of strengthen. But I imagine someone that's full black, that's a convert, to deal with this stuff, to find out these things, and not have what I had, which was the deep-rooted Mormon pioneer, this is my heritage, I will never move from this. that kept me grounded. It kept me there because I still felt like this was my church. My family's been a part of this church from the very beginning. But someone that's a convert, that may be grappling with this type of thinking, is different. And I wonder if the leaders, the brethren, recognize the mental gymnastics that someone that is of color has to deal with some of this race-based curse mark skin color theology that still exists. It's still there.
I mean, how can they? I mean, they're not black. And so I think this is where some of the issue comes in. When blacks raise these issues, I think sometimes we, the white leaders, will say things that are kind of dismissive, like, oh, well, yes, have faith, don't worry about it, you know, I'm sure it'll all be worked out. But we're not the ones having to, again, expend that type of mental energy on a daily basis and have it affect our self-esteems or our mental health or our relationships with, you know, people. And so this is kind of one of those things where either you're going to believe somebody who's in that position and take them seriously, or you're going to just assume all is well because you think it's all well.
Right. Yeah, because I think I bring it up is because, like you said, you don't have to think about it every day. It's not something that's at the front of your mind. Whereas someone like myself, as much as you are wanting to not make it an issue, it's there. It's in the theology. It's, you read the scriptures. I mean, you can't read the Book of Mormon and not even see the skin color issue with the Lamanites and the filthy.
How did you deal with that as a missionary? Preaching to Hispanics and people that were of different color in general, what did you find was the acceptance of that teaching? And how? Another question I have too is, were you guys ever taught how to deal with these types of issues, like in places like the MTC? I never served a mission, so I don't know what type of direction you were given.
Well, it's funny you'd ask, because yeah, we're going to New York, and I, because I had studied these issues were real to me, I knew them. I was the one that the elders would go to kind of help explain something if it ever came up. I mean, a lot of them just had no idea how to even address this. There was no specific training with respect to these issues. It didn't come up a whole lot with the Hispanic community. For some reason, I don't know if it was just the depth of what we were teaching. We just didn't get into the race issues at all, and it's just not part of the script, for lack of a better word. It's not part of the presentation materials. It's not part of what you're giving the membership. So you're not going into these issues.
So most converts don't really face these issues until they're already members, and then coming across them in teachings or in attitudes of other members along the way.
Absolutely. You're gonna become a member of the church. You're gonna be welcomed with open arms, and then sometime early in your journey, you may be exposed to some of these teachings. And some don't know how to react to them. Again, I had been exposed to most of this doctrinal explanation stuff. I had had a lifetime to process and get through and understand.
With a lifetime, you were really struggling.
yeah. But part of it, I think, was just me. The Canaanite thing, the preexistence, and then the patriarchal blessing, reaffirming that I'm not of Israel, and me really probably this overachiever in me. I want to do what's right. I want to prove myself. It really was real to me. And again, probably being a thinker, someone else that may not think about these things and just blow it off or whatever. But I know that it is a teaching that has existed. These things are there that are very hurtful. I mean, you read these things. I mean, Bristol McConkie, again, I remember this was one that I remember reading and just kind of scratching my head, where he's kind of explaining kind of a caste system and segregation as well, you know, the distinction of races. And he talks about Cain and Ham, and the whole Negro race have been cursed with a black skin, the mark of Cain, so they can be identified as a caste apart, a people with whom the other descendants of Adam should not intermarry. Right. And I'm thinking of my mom, and I'm thinking she got excommunicated, and what was going on with the LDS family services, and my grandmother struggling with me being born. There was no other way to react to it but the way my grandmother did. It was devastating to her. And it is what it is.
Right.
I mean, it's hurtful. It's. I think now, and it's kind of funny because now, as I've grown up, I don't have a problem talking about these issues and speaking frankly about these, obviously, because this is something I live. But the majority of members, this is something. It's like it's taboo. It's a taboo. Right. It's a non-discussable. It's one of those things that members, the majority of members, would rather not talk about.
Right.
And I'm always like, why would we want to shut? Let's just talk about this. Let's figure this thing out. I always have to talk to my friends and say, you don't realize that I have to have an explanation. I have black friends. I encounter people who are black. I remember talking to missionaries. I said, they're going to look at me and go, why are you with them? Why are you with the Mormons? They're racist. I, as a black member, I have to have an explanation for that.
Right.
I can't just say, I don't know, I just have faith and I follow along. I can't do that. That's just not a plausible response, that I just have faith, I don't look at it, it doesn't bother me. And you're like, wait a minute, these are the leaders of your church that said these things and that doesn't bother you? It's not an explanation. So for me, as a black member of the church, these are real issues. These are things that I have to be able to explain to people that I encounter that know I'm a Mormon, know I'm black, and know of what our leaders have taught about black people. Right. It's as much as I have the mental gymnastics to understand it, they're looking at me going, are you a fool or what? Why would you be a part of this? And being, again, having this strong testimony, this rooted in the gospel, I was one of those that would always try to find a way to explain it.
Right. Well, it's I mean, I think it's similar to anybody in a type of abusive type of relationship. I mean, this is a total, I guess, tangent on my part. But, you know, for instance, a woman who might be, I don't know, in a relationship where she's being abused physically. And we ask, why would you stay in that type of a relationship, you know, where you know you're being hurt and demeaned and you know, people kind of don't really understand that. You know, in a way, this is type of an abusive type of relationship with your authority figure, which is the leader of your, you know, your church leaders, which in many ways act as parental figures. And so you're being asked to defend an abusive parent in a way, an abusive relationship, and the whys of why you would stay in such a relationship.
Yeah, I'd never thought about it kind of as an abusive relationship. I look at the quotes, look at these things, scratch my head, not have any explanation, not know why.
Well, I know, and if somebody was telling my kid this stuff, I would consider it abusive.
But see, that's where now, I mean, I've had discussions with my wife about this. If my kid comes home with hearing any of this stuff, I'm going down to the church.
Yeah.
Because I know how it affected me. It affected me. Even to this day, I mean, up until even a year ago, I was struggling with this as I served in leadership, as I served in the church, and not, I mean, I'm in the bishopric. I remember standing at the podium conducting sacrament meeting as a counselor in the bishopric, and not feeling 100% that I was being accepted, that the membership accepted me as a leader in the church. I remember serving on the High Council and having similar feelings that I was not being perceived as 100% a part and belonging. It was struggling. So I'd emotionally tried, okay, I really need to prove myself. I really need to do what I need to do. I was one of those missionaries that I was studying everything almost to the point of anxiety, stressing about exactness and worrying about being the 100% perfect black child of Heavenly Father to show Him that whatever happened in the preexistence, I'm sorry.
Right. And it doesn't follow a normal repentance pattern, because you can't even admit to what you did wrong, and you can't even take responsibility because you don't even know. And so it's a never-ending kind of repentance process you're put through, because, you know, you never quite know if you're done repenting from it. And since your skin is still black, then it's a constant reminder.
But you know, you had those teachings, though. I remember my mom and my grandmother this is comical as well now that I think about it, was there was the teachings that I know that Spencer W. Kimball and others talked about your race, your skin getting lighter as mm-hmm. the race got more righteous.
Mm-hmm. Especially with the Native Americans, that was yes. very much, yeah. yes.
I know, yeah, he talked about that, and it was applied to blacks as well. And I remember them talking about, see, you see the black people? They're getting lighter. They're getting lighter because they're getting righteous. And if you're mm-hmm. righteous, Dustin, your skin will get lighter too. And that's just what happens. It's one of the blessings.
Did somebody actually tell you that?
Yeah, my grandmother told me that.
Oh, wow.
I love her to death. But, right. And she was just, she's just going off what the brethren were teaching. I mean, that's the reality of it. I can't look at her and judge her at all. She was teaching what the church was teaching, what the brethren are teaching. I mean, someone may say, well, the church wasn't teaching that. That was just McConkie. That was just so-and-so. Well, they're the voice of the church. How do you make the distinction as a lay member of the church that they're that Elder Packard's speaking for himself? He's not speaking for the church. He's standing at the pulpit in conference, and he's saying these things, or he's published a book, and this is what he's saying. The average member doesn't make the distinction that this is someone that's official statement. Because I had a discussion recently with one of members of my stake presidency on some of these issues, some of these statements, and the defensive posture is that's their opinion. It was never church's teaching. It was never doctrine. And it wasn't official. And I just kind of scratched my head, and I go, really? Would you say the same thing about Elder Oaks going off and speaking at universities in opposition to same-sex marriage? Is that just his personal opinion? I think when members read his talk and read what he says as he's speaking at this law school in opposition to same-sex marriage, you don't just say that's just his personal opinion. You assume he's speaking for the Lord, or he's speaking for the church. Or any other context. If Elder Packer is speaking from the pulpit, you assume that. But for some reason, when it's a statement such as these that are distant, more distant, we more easily distance our belief in them, and we're more willing to say, well, they were wrong. Well, they were false. They were speaking their own opinion. As opposed to where I know my grandmother believed this, as this was the absolute truth. This was the gospel as it was taught to her. And it was the gospel that was taught to me that I needed to accept and believe if I really wanted to show my faithfulness.
Do you think that this is maybe at the root of why church leaders maybe shrink away from offering official apologies? Is this idea that, well, if we apologize for something that was said, you know, 50 years ago, and we say, yeah, that person who was a prophet and who was a seer and a revelator, you know, if we now apologize for something that they said, how is that going to affect our credibility as current prophets, seers, and revelators with the things that we are currently saying? Like, people will just start saying, well, that could be them talking as a prophet versus that could be them just sharing an opinion.
I think that is probably something that they struggle with. But I don't know how you wiggle out or how you have it both ways. If you look at General Conference, October 2010 General Conference, Elder Costa from Brazil gave a talk on the 14 Fundamentals of Prophet. And he essentially restated Elder Benson's talk that he gave back in the 80s, I believe, that talking about the 14 Fundamentals of a Prophet. And he goes through these fundamental principles, and it's very clear that when he says a prophet, he's talking about a prophet, and that I believe, and if you go on to LDS.org, it talks about the obedience to the prophet and prophets, plural. And so he's speaking, in my mind, it's the collective 15, First Presidency and the other 12. They're the ones that we sustain as prophets, seers, and revelators. And I believe that was the case even back in the time of my grandparents. That you're sustaining those 15 as prophets, seers, and revelators. And so, and in that talk that Elder Costa gives, he reaffirms that these prophets, when they speak for the Lord, and that they don't have to be trained on the topic. It doesn't have to be a theological, spiritual topic for them to be speaking for the Lord. And it just, I mean, there's not a lot of wiggle room to begin explaining, well, that's just their personal opinion, or that's not, you don't have to believe that. I listened to that talk last October, and again, it was very clear to me that what the brethren say is the will of the Lord. I mean, it's God's will. These are the prophets speaking. These are the prophets. They are apostles, seers, and revelators. So applying that same analysis, I don't know how you look back at some of these ancient statements or the older statements, Brigham Young, and even the more recent statements, and just dismiss them as, well, that's what they were thinking. Unless there's an official dismissal. You'd officially have to abrogate and disavow what has been said from an official position. I know that there are some statements that Elder Oaks and I believe Elder Holland made in their interviews with PBS where they talk about some of these statements in the past that were given by some of these leaders. And I believe they even intimate or suggest that they were wrong, that these leaders may have been wrong, something to that effect. But it's very subtle, and it's not over the pulpit. It's not at General Conference, which is where most members are going to be looking for the truths. It's going to be printed in the Ensign. It's going to be on LDS.org. It's not in an interview with some reporter. So I think that the brethren may struggle with potentially that slippery slope of when you start dismissing something or giving an official apology, it may call into question some things that are more contemporary. But I think that members are astute enough and smart enough to figure things out. I mean, I don't know.
Right. Well, we see a lot of these same issues around the topic of polygamy. Not that we need to go there because that's a whole another 3 hours. But, you know, where really there has never been an official statement rescinding the doctrine itself. You know, we still practice the doctrine in the temple, but we say we right. just don't practice it at this current time. And then, you know, so I'm left feeling, okay, so as a member of the church, do I believe in polygamy or not? You know, like what am I really claiming here? And almost being left to my own devices to decide if I'm going to believe in that doctrine or not, because nobody's talking about it or teaching me about it. It's just kind of all swept under a rug. And it seems similar to that. Like things just mm-hmm. are never, addressed, more directly.
Thank you for joining us today on Mormon Stories. Music today was provided by the Saber Rattlers. Check them out at saber-rattlers.com. The Mormon Stories logo was generously donated by StudioCase.com. Thanks for listening.
Come, come, ye saints, no toil nor labor fear, but with joy wend your way. Though hard to you this journey may appear, grace shall be as your day. 'Tis better far for us to strive our useless cares from us to drive, to the sand joy. Your hearts will swell, oh, all is well, all is well. So all is should we die before our journey's through?